Curse.
Welcome to Speaking to Troy, episode 101. Speaking to Troy is the first podcast featuring interviews about Metallica, and I am your host, Ryan J. Downey. My guest this episode is Christina Scabbia of Lacuna Coil. I know I say this a lot because I've been blessed to have a lot of great conversations through the course of doing this podcast now for over 100 episodes, but this was one of my absolute favorite conversations. In my 20 plus years of being a music journalist, working as an artist manager, and various other roles in the quote unquote biz, she's actually someone that I had never spoken to before. I saw Lacuna Coil for the first time in 2004 on Ozzfest. I was there in my role as manager for Throwdown and at the time the band Bleeding Through, who also returned in 2006, which Lacuna Coil was on both of those years as well, 2004 and 2006. We have a lot of mutual friends, including their former manager, a bunch of the staff, and the old ownership at Century Media. But we'd never spoken, and I've always been a fan and admirer. She is massively talented, super charismatic, as you will hear in this conversation, very charming, insightful. It was just a really, really great chat that went in a lot of different directions, but of course, with a focus on Metallica. Now, if you were not familiar, the reason why I invited Christina to come onto the podcast is because she has said in interviews before that the Black Album was actually the first like heavy record that she heard and the thing that got her into this style of music. About 10 years ago, at a charity concert in Europe, she actually sang Nothing Else Matters with a cover band. It was like a whole tribute night with a bunch of vocals from a bunch of different bands. You can find that on YouTube, but yeah, she was backed by a little orchestra. So we talk about that. We talk about the origins of Lacuna Coil and get into a rather fascinating discussion about the relationship of bands and their audience, particularly bands who evolve and change over the years, like Lacuna Coil, like Paradise Lost, like Typo Negative, and like Metallica. Remember, the best way to support this podcast is to go into Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast platform of choice. Leave a 5-star rating, write a nice little review. Those really do help. You can also support the show on Patreon, where you get access to exclusive bonus episodes called from my interview archives with Metallica adjacent folks like Glenn Danzig, Randy Blythe from Lamb of God, and not one, but two interviews with Kirk the Ripper Von Hammett. You can follow Speaking to Troy on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can find me on Twitter at Ryan Downey and on Instagram at Superhero HQ. Speaking to Troy is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network. So here it is, my conversation with Christina Scabbia of Lacuna Coil. This is Speak and Destroy. Time goes by so quickly. It's probably been like 10 years ago, but I remember you did a Christmas show with an orchestra where you sang Nothing Else Matters.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. I can't remember the year, but yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. So you just seemed like a perfect guest to have on. So
thank you. It was my idea. It was my idea. Yes, because I mean, I can genuinely say that Metallica was the very first metal band that I've ever heard.
Yeah,
ever when I wasn't even remotely close to become a singer in the band or meeting the other members of Lacuna Coil from the first lineup. Wow. I remember that I was still living with my parents, and I remember that I was just like meeting up, you know, with the same group of friends every day. And one day, one of them just brought, you know, a cassette player, and it was just like, oh, you got to listen to this, and just played some Metallica for me. And I was like, what is this? Because I mean, I grew up in a family with two brothers and a sister that listened to a lot of music, but not metal music. The heaviest thing was a record from AC/DC, but the rest was all Pink Floyd, Beatles, the Genesis. I mean, I'm not complaining at all.
Yeah, I was gonna say great stuff.
Of course, but, yeah. It was great stuff. It was great stuff, you know, electronic music from the 80s, some rap, hip hop, everything, but metal, surprisingly. I don't know why. So when I heard, you know, this music coming from this cassette, I was just like, I was very impressed because it was something that I've never heard before in my world. So I started asking questions. I was like, what is this? What is that? You know, of course, I mainly loved, you know, the mellower songs back then, because I was still kind of like attracted, tempted, but still not quite ready, maybe. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I kept, you know, the name of this band in the back of my mind, and I was just like, they might come back later. So I, let's say, improved my knowledge in metal in, I think it was 1993. So I was not like super young, you know. It's something that I discovered later, because I started to hang out in a metal pub in Milano that is not existing anymore, called Midnight Pub. And that's where actually I met the guys of Lacuna Coil, at least Andrea and Marco and the guys from the previous lineup. Mm-hmm. And they were playing metal music. So whole universe opened up for me. And the same friend who actually made me listen to Metallica brought me to this pub. So I had the chance, you know, to listen to stuff that what was probably close to my taste as a transition. Yeah. So I fell in love, you know, with Typo Negative, with Paradise Lost, you know, bands that had melodies into it. And I gradually went into something heavier, falling in love with it and understanding more about this music that was sounding, you know, different from the music that I'd listened to.
I'm glad you mentioned Typo and Paradise Lost, because when I was making some notes last night, I came across an article, I think it was with Metal Hammer, where they had asked you to name 10 albums that had changed your life. And the Black Album was on there, but also Metallica is my favorite band of all time. Typo Negative is my second favorite band of all time.
And I think it's my favorite one. Well, it's not that I have a favorite band, but yeah, definitely they are a band that massively, massively influenced Lacuna Coil, not only with their music at first, but then we had the chance, you know, to meet the guys. And I think it's magical when you meet your idols and they're even better than you're expecting, because you know how it is, you know, sometimes you're afraid to meet someone you admire because you're afraid that they're going to be assholes, they're going to be, you know, too full of themselves, and they will make you go like, oh, why did I even, you know, support this person? You know, it might be the greatest musician of all time, but what an asshole. And, you know, just knowing them and meeting them increased my respect towards the band. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I love October Rust. I mean, I love every Typo record. Paradise Lost also. And it's interesting you mentioned them in terms of that gateway, as you say, and that transition with melody and heaviness. Because Paradise Lost, you know, Draconian Times, I think, is a very... It's almost like a cousin to the Black Album.
Yeah, but then I love Draconian Times. I think it's my favorite one. Mm. I think it's probably my favorite record from them. And yeah, you know, sometimes you need like a song that kind of brings you in that vibe that maybe you would have never go through. You know, yeah. Probably I needed to listen to something more mellow and melodic, which was still super dark. So mm-hmm. I still consider it metal, because I mean, for me, metal is a lot more than just like noise and chaos. I mean, for me, it's way more complex, you know, it's just not just a just a lifestyle, like rock and roll, metal, pretty much, you know, the same thing. But metal, it's more deep. If rock and roll, it's more fun. I think that metal goes way deeper, you know, into the roots of your own psychology sometimes. You know, it make you just like, you know, bang your head and just like go crazy at parties. But it also makes you think and just like, oh wow, I felt this thing right into my heart that kind of made me think about something very, very deep. At least that's what it does to me.
No, yeah, you've spoken before in interviews I've seen about that feeling of transcendence and almost the otherworldliness that music can give, where it's like you're in another dimension or something when it's when you're performing or when you're hearing it. And yeah, and I'm very much the same way, very immersive. And I think that's what I love about bands like Typo and Paradise Lost and My Dying Bride, is it has that ability to take you somewhere, you know, like outside of what's happening around you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I similar to you, you know, I was into melody and everything first before I discovered metal. I loved, you know, and I still do, Depeche Mode and The Cure and The Smiths and Generation X and a lot of those kind of bands was the first music that I really loved. So I think it made sense that as I got into metal, and then as bands came along like Paradise Lost, and then when Paradise Lost had like their Depeche Mode phase, you know, there were some fans that were like, "Oh, I hate this new Paradise Lost," and I was like, "I love this phase."
I love it. Me too. I am honestly, on your side on this. I don't like it when people are just like criticizing artists that are just like trying something different. For me, the most important thing is the honesty of the artist, because even if I love an artist's music or style, to me, it would be really contrived to rewrite the same record over and over if you don't really believe in it. You can do something like that. I mean, you can, you know, be, I don't know, AC/DC and just like do the same kind of music and people will love it, but they want to know it too. If an artist wants to experiment, wants to try something different because they really want to, I think it's something that you should support. Whatever, you don't like the record, whatever. I mean, it was their choice. Maybe I will get the next record and I will like it more. But I don't see it as a betrayal towards the fans, because if an artist would write exactly what the fans want, it would be a product. It would be like, okay, guys, just let me know. I'm going to put a poll out. What kind of music do you want? How many instruments? How long the songs should last? I mean, that would be horrible. That would be something done on commission. And it's like,
it's like art.
I mean, of course, you can be free to do something on commission. Like, I don't know, you have to write a song over, I don't know, a movie. So you have to follow a specific theme. You have to talk about specific things. But when you're doing your own record, you need to be honest with yourself, because you as an artist, you're going to be responsible to bring your music around the world. You will have to believe in what you're singing and playing, and you will always have to be proud throughout the years of what you're putting out. I could never think of myself as just like playing something that I'm like, ugh, I hate this song. Why do I have to sing it? Ugh. I could never do something like this.
Yeah, and I think that the audience can sense that authenticity and that honesty, and that's what we connect to. You know, when we hear a James Hetfield or a Peter Steele, you know, we connect to the raw truth that we know is in there. Yeah, that it's not music by committee. It's not designed to be a product.
And also, it is really difficult to reproduce the same vibe that you get from older records, because I mean, I am the same. There are some records that I'm absolutely attached to. And if I listen to them right now, I'm like, the production sucked. it was not sung very well. Maybe the lyrics were, if you really want to analyze everything. But the vibe of this record is unparalleled. I love it like nothing else, because it reminds me of this period of my life. So every time I hear this music, I relive this part of my life. I smell the same smells that I felt back then. I just close my eyes and I think about what I was doing, how I was dressed, the people that I was going out with. And you can't reproduce the same thing. If you would do a record that is exactly the same of a record that you did 20 years ago, it would never be the same because time changed. People are changing, luckily, are growing. They might have, you know, a different taste. They lived different experiences. So it's kind of silly to expect the same thing over and over from an artist, you know. Sometimes when they ask me, like, why don't you do a record like, I don't know, In a Reverie? Because In a Reverie was written in 1998. I can't be the same person I was in 1998. It would be to wear the same pair of pants for 30 years. You know, there might be, you know, the time that you can't enter anymore in these pants or you want to change them. Maybe you still keep these pants, but.
Yeah, and that's what's great about this kind of art, especially with records. And you could say the same with filmmakers. You know, part of what makes that record beautiful is that it's a snapshot of who you were as an artist in 1998. And that's not who you are now. And it shouldn't be. You need to grow and evolve and change. And the purity of that is still there. Like you said, when you want to put on one of those records and be transported back to that time rather than trying to chase recreating that time for its own sake.
It's like a picture. I mean, you would never manipulate a picture of you 20 years ago. Yeah, you maybe would do it because it's like, I don't know, now social medias are fucking weird, but you leave it there. You just look at it and it's just like, oh, wow, that was me 20 years ago. But then you just go on with your life and thank goodness that you have more experience to talk about and things that you can put in your art.
Mm-hmm. And I think we often overlook that our relationship to certain records, movies, books has a lot to do with who we were at the time that we encountered it. So you're never going to hear Metallica for the first time again. You're never going to hear Lacuna Coil for the first time again. So whatever record was the record in that moment when you discovered them and whatever was happening for you, relationships you were in or whatever, that's a time and a place that's so specific that you're sort of unfairly judging artists as the new records come out because of who you were when you got into them, you know? I think we forget that. And
the same reason why you might criticize something because it doesn't encounter your morals or your taste. That's the only reason why you do it, because because you're comparing to who you are. And if you think about it, maybe the fact that you want an artist to do the same thing over and over, it's a sort of a jealousy of the music that you love, because you would always want it this way. You would always want to protect it. You don't want to change it. Like, I don't have kids, but it's like I compare it as having a kids and not wanting this kid to grow up.
Yes.
To grow and run away from you. So it's like, I want to keep it closer. So if it's similar to what I like, I still feel protected and I still feel somehow in control of the artist that I love.
Oh, wow. That is so insightful. And that is such a great comparison because with children, you want, there's the part of you that's like, oh, I want them to stay 4 years old and snuggly and this and that. But you also don't want to rob them of the experience of being a teenager and an adult and whatever. Yeah. And that's
be free, but not too much.
Yeah. And exactly.
Come back, please.
Yeah. And it reminds me, you know, in the 90s, some of my metalhead friends, when Metallica cut their hair and that was controversial.
Oh my God.
I remember saying to my friends at the time who were complaining about it, we cut our hair. You know, these were my friends who all had long hair in high school and whatever and whatever. And they didn't have long hair now. And they were complaining, oh, Metallica cut their hair. And it's like, yeah, you want them to stay frozen in time, but
exactly.
You're allowed to grow and change in life. So yeah, I think it's
because we want to protect our memories. I think it is. I think that's the reason why.
Yeah. Yeah. And doing so, man, like you said, like with children, if you were able to freeze them in time, for as great as that is, what about everything that you're missing that would have come later had you allowed it to progress the way that it should.
Yeah, and also, I think, I mean, it's cool to think that you will always have a surprise because you still have these records that you love. Mm-hmm. So they're there. Nobody's going to touch them. Yeah. Nobody is going to take them away from you or your memories or the love that you feel for them. You know, there is always something new that you can discover, like a new travel. You might discover something that you like. You might discover other bands connected that you like, and it just like expand your musical taste. That there is nothing bad about it.
No, and that's the, I mean, we're here for such a short period of time on this earth, you know, to limit ourselves to the first few things that we love.
That's true, but we always do it.
But we do it anyway.
But we do it all the time. It's a classic. That's a classic.
So you mentioned your siblings and a lot of great music that was around. Were your parents musical? Were they listening to stuff? Or
My mom wasn't. My mom couldn't even turn on a radio. Like, she was not anti-electronic things, but she was not good at it. My dad was the opposite. I mean, when he was around 85, he actually subscribed to a computer course, you know, to learn how to use computer. Wow. And he loved music very, very much. I mean, every day it would take like 1 hour, 2 hours, and you would see him sitting in a couch with headphones on and with eyes closed and just like listening to music. He loved U2 very, very much. He loved Celtic music, but he was listening to a little bit of everything. And it was awesome because sometimes he would ask me like, do you know this band? Well, have you ever heard about this band? Yeah, Dad, I know U2. I like them.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It was the sweetest thing.
My parents were reversed, or my mother was very into music and played a lot of music around the house, and Johnny Cash and Dolly Parton, and my dad has just never been, you know, he's never had a record collection. He's never had CDs. There was one time where my brother and I were riding in the car with him as adults, and he was listening to a CD in the car, which was already weird. But it was like Muzak elevator versions of Beatles songs. And we were like, Dad, what are you listening to? And he was like, oh, my friend at work burned this CD for me. I really like it. I like driving and listening to it. And my brother and I were like, you know, these are Beatles songs, right? He had no idea.
He's like, to each his own. My mom didn't listen to music, but she was a great singer though. Sometimes, you know, when she was ironing or doing stuff, she would sing in a very classical way a woman could sing, like with a lot of vibratos at the end, just like, oh, but she was great. I was like, wow.
That's awesome. So that first bit of Metallica that you heard, at what point, and maybe it wasn't Metallica, you know, but at what point did you sort of reach that turning point where music went from something that you absolutely loved to something that you knew you needed to participate in? You know, you need to create, you want to perform, you want to be
actively with Lacuna Coil. Before Lacuna Coil, I basically, life always brought me into the singing thing, whether I liked it or not, even though I didn't want to be in the spot. Because I love to sing. I remember that I was just like going out, you know, in dance clubs with my brothers that were playing mainly dance music, you know, just like regular clubs. And my DJ friends would make me sing some of the songs or over the songs. And I remember that I was always hiding because I love to sing, but I didn't want anybody to see me or see who was singing. So it was like for my pure pleasure and, you know, my friends, because they liked my voice. So they started asking me to record some stuff for them. So I would stay in a room, let's say for, I don't know, an hour, just like singing over some loops, and then they would take the parts and they would just like juggle them however they wanted to, and they were just like making records out of them. But I didn't want to appear because I just felt that it wasn't the right music for me. I mean, I liked dance music, but I didn't want to give my image or my name. I just didn't want to be that involved for some reason. I remember we went to a convention as well. It was a dance music convention. And I just didn't feel it. I just didn't feel it. I just came back home and I was just like, And after a couple of months, probably was like a few years after, I met the guys in Lacuna Coil and I found out that I wanted to be there. I just wanted to do something with them, that I wanted to create a project with them. It was more exciting. I knew them. They were friends. So it's just like, okay, let's try this. I remember I was super, super shy in the beginning. Very first concerts, I was like hiding myself, you know, behind the microphone band like this. Because I just wanted to sing, but I wasn't the type of person, and probably I still am, that is like, hey, look at me. Yeah, I'm the most gorgeous, most intelligent, smartest lady in the room. I never really felt the need, you know, to put all the light around me. And with them, I learned a lot, because obviously I changed a lot, even on a stage, on the recording, my voice, and songwriting skills, if you can call them so, improved. I changed as a person. And it's because I am with my second family, basically.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And what do you think helped? Do you remember kind of a turning point going from wanting to sort of hide on stage and be behind the mic stand and maybe put your hair in your face? Do you remember kind of when you noticed like, oh, wait, I'm more comfortable here now?
Not a very specific point. But I remember that once I hit myself with a microphone stand that it just like turned as soon as I was doing it at banging, and then I caught my face open here, like starting to bleed. And I was just like, maybe no more mic stands. And then we started, you know, with wireless whenever possible. And that's where I slowly started to uncover myself to the crowd and just like being more comfortable. I still feel that I want this barrier in front of me, because I really wish, you know, that I could just like be in my own cloud and see everybody so everybody can see me too, but just like, you know, let me do my thing. Sometimes I feel that, but then I like the interaction too, so it's like but I think it's something that I've learned through time. I wasn't like that back then. I know that a lot of artists are just like, yeah, I always dreamt about, you know, being a rock star. Nope.
Yeah. And I feel like that juxtaposition, I mean, it certainly works in your favor. It works in the favor of a lot of artists, where the art of it, it's not to disparage anybody who had that yearning and that need to be famous and be seen. But when your yearning and your need was to connect to the music and make the music and put that out there, and the rest of it is sort of secondary, I think that that's better for the art at the end of the day.
I think that every person has a different style, because I mean, there are things that you can't really do on command, and personality is one of those things. You have your own personality, so you can try to be, you know, the most egocentric singer on stage. But if you're not an egocentric in real life, it's going to be really hard, because you can fake somehow, you know, that you're super confident, but then I think that it will be very evident that you're not, and or the other way around. I mean, I think that a live show, it's so raw that in the end your personality comes out for who you for who you really are, sooner or later.
I find that my favorite lead singers, that there's a mix of this hyper-confidence and self-assurance and vulnerability and insecurity, that it's like both the duality in a lot of you singers, you great singers, is heightened both, you know, because it takes a lot
of... I'm glad that you said that, because a lot of people, I think, mistakes and misunderstands what vulnerability is. So they take it as something negative.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just like, oh, if this person is vulnerable or insecure, then can't be on a stage and can't be a good lead singer or a guitar player, whatever. But charisma is not just made about, is not made of self-confidence. It's something that goes behind everything, you know.
Yes.
It's just the aura of this person. And the aura of a person is made by so many different things. I don't know. The singer of Red Hot Chili Peppers, super egocentric. It's charismatic on its own. The singer of Radiohead, to me, is the same level of charismatic. But if you mm-hmm. put them on a mirror, they are like completely different.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people mistakes vulnerability and just like maybe misanthropy sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
As something against not being a rock star, but against self-confidence. Because the fact that you're insecure sometimes, it doesn't really mean that you're not self-confident. Maybe it's just the wrong approach.
Yeah.
Or maybe you can be in different situation and not all the times.
And oftentimes people mistake one for the other as well, because I think of, you know, Fiona Apple, Morrissey, you know, they're very self-assured and very in touch with who they are, but express so much vulnerability and insecurity in their music. Or Peter Steele, you know, he's this like, you know, 9 foot tall, statuesque, you know, sexy, cool, philosophical, deep. And so much of that music is self-effacing and self-doubt and self-loathing and these very real, yeah, vulnerabilities, as you say it. Or James Hetfield, where he can stand in front of a crowd of tens of thousands of people and command that whole audience, but then off stage he's very shy and withdrawn, and you know, and people interpret that sometimes as like, oh, this guy's intimidating. And it's like, no, he's nervous, sir. You know, he's and I think all of that, yeah, you put it so well. It's charisma. And that charisma can come from not just a place of, oh, this person's so beautiful or this person's so talented, but from all sorts of areas. And
yes, and the perception of people can change so fast.
Mm.
That's what I've noticed, especially now with social medias. If you want, you can really change the perception of people in such a short time. And, you know, sometimes there is also the risk of manipulating people's tastes, which I think it's probably part of the game.
Yeah.
But I noticed that. I mean, you can appear like the most self-centered person in the world while you're not. You can appear like super strong and maybe you are the more insecure person in the world. And people's perception is important in the music business. I'm not saying that is important in life, but if you look at the marketing point of view, mm-hmm. the perception from the outside, it's what gives you the aura that you might not have. So yeah. It's kind of crazy.
It's a little bit of magic in that sense when done correctly.
It is.
Yeah.
Just to give you a very, very, very stupid example that is not even related to music. I'm very active on socials because I like to, you know, keep in touch with our fans to keep them informed in what we do. I never do anything too private, but I like to let them enter, you know, in my life, what I do every day. The non rock star musical tour things, more, you know, on a personal level. And during the lockdown, I started to work out a bit, but just like, you know, regular workout that you would do on your own. It's just like, okay, I'm going to do a little bit of exercises at home. And I started to play video games more because, I mean, I stopped it when we started the tour. I didn't really play, but I love video games. I love the whole nerd world, as you can somehow.
I see Gizmo back there. I see. Yes.
Yeah. Oh yeah, with the face of the kid of Fallout. Yes. The video game. Yes, it's. There is Gizmo and
there's Gizmo and there's Stripe back there. Is that Stripe?
Exactly, the big yeah. Stripe back there. So I remember that 2-3 months after I did an interview with a UK magazine that wanted to know how the lockdown was doing, what I was doing, blah blah blah. And one of the first questions that he made was just like, so we have heard that you are a pro gamer. And an expert of fitness, a fitness expert. And I was just like, what? What and what? And they were like, yeah, because I mean, we see a lot of pictures that you're working out. And yeah, but I'm not a pro. I'm not a fitness expert. I'm not a pro gamer. I like video games. I love video games. I'm playing video games. I exercise every day just to keep in shape or eat more according to how you want to see it. But just to tell you the perception, I mean, if I wanted to, and it's because I don't want to, but if I wanted to, I would publish specific pictures that would completely change the view of the world on me. If I would only post, I don't know, super elaborated pictures as a diva, I would turn into a diva in a few months. Mm. Because people forget very easily on medias and sees you as who you are at the moment. They never scroll back too much. And they tend to, for everything is so fast right now. Everything is just like, I don't know the term in English. In Italian will be phagocytated. I don't know if it's existing, but eaten very fast. So this is another crazy thing, you know, how you can change the perception.
And I think we forget that we're only seeing a very limited in anyone's lives via social media. Even those who seem like they are putting every single thing out there.
No, we see nothing. We see nothing because, I mean, it's pretty clear that everybody posts, you know, the best parts.
Yeah.
Yeah. The best parts or the normal parts, but it's really, really difficult, you know, to see the very low ones. And whenever I see them, it always looks like they are almost done on purpose to get somewhere else.
And a lot of times when you see selfies, you wonder how many pictures exactly like that one are in that person's camera roll.
Oh, usually it's a lot. Usually it's a lot.
I'm guilty of it too. We're all guilty.
Me too. You know? I'm saying the same thing, but I mean, it's...
Oh, as soon as I found out when we started being a journalist and, you know, communicating so much over Zoom since the pandemic started, as soon as I realized that there is an option to put this slight filter on, I've had it on ever since. You know, it's like, just, you know, small amount of vanity, but
the important thing is
to realize that all those tricks that you're doing yourself, everyone else is doing them too, you know, because that's the problem, is we compare ourselves to everything that we're seeing.
I don't think there's anything wrong with vanity. I mean, the real problem to me is when people don't realize when real life starts. That is the problem, because if you want to put a filter and you feel prettier, it's okay. But then if you get frustrated because in real life you're not looking like this, and you're never going to look like this, because in real life you have pores, you have a real face.
Yeah.
That's where the problem starts. But I don't think the problem itself is the filter.
Yeah. And people and all the, as a guy, something, you know, that you would always hear of this, like, exercise ideal. People would always say, like, Brad Pitt in Fight Club. I want to look like Brad Pitt in Fight Club. And it's like, yeah, but you don't realize that Brad Pitt doesn't even look like Brad Pitt in Fight Club. You know, he looked like that on set for a couple of days by the right amount of water that he drank or didn't drink. And that he, you know what I mean? It's like, you don't, no one's like that constantly. Nor should they be, nor should they have to be, you know? And it's like, and it's great to have that movie and to have someone, you know, achieve that. But it's important for us all to remember when we're comparing everything that, like, yeah, like you said, it's just a
back with real life. That's the real problem.
Yeah, indeed. So this is the 30th anniversary of the Black Album this year, which is absolutely crazy to me. Especially, you know, I'm one of those. I just talked to a friend of mine who's actually a few years younger than I am, who yesterday was still referring to the Black Album as the new stuff. It's the later Metallica, you know. Have you been following some of the stuff that they've been announcing and like some of the cover songs?
No, to be honest, not really, because now we're focusing on our record as well. Mm. And I don't really follow what other bands are doing. I mean, I follow my friends that I just like follow on Instagram. So sometimes they appear, but I don't really spy into other bands' life, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it's probably better that way when you are in record making mode, especially because then you're not too influenced by everything that's around.
We never really were influenced, just because I mean we like music in general. We are very attentive to what we hear, even if they're not bands. We like, for example, a lot soundtracks. We like soundtracks very much, whether they are from movies or video games. Sometimes I just like, you know, Spotify to, okay, let's put the soundtrack off. I'm going to put this one just to enter in that mood.
I like that. You know, and obviously that's music that is very cinematic. I want to talk about that performance with the orchestra. I think it was 2009, the Christmas show, but it was, you know, the singer from Sabaton was there, Udo from Accept, and Udo was there, did Fast as a Shark, I think.
Yeah, it's a sort of a like an old band with different musicians, and they always have different guests.
Yeah.
And it has been a while, but they were doing it, you know, under Christmas. And I did it a couple of times with them. I remember the last time it was super snowy. It snowed so much that some people couldn't even make it to the show because it was impossible to move.
Mm. So there was a 30-piece orchestra there. Was that right?
I don't remember how many, but it was big. A full orchestra. Yeah, big yeah. One. Yeah.
Was that your first time singing with a big
yes.
orchestra like that?
Yes, it was. It was my first time. It was... it is always different when you're not playing with your own band, because, you know, the old vibe changes. I remember that it was a little bit weird because it wasn't really in my key, but I wanted to keep the key of the song because I wanted everybody to sing it and I'll just like do it because I could do it better with my voice. I didn't really care about that. And it's a song that I always loved.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was one of the first songs that I've heard of Metallica.
I love that song is such a gateway too, because the, you know, the origin story of that song, it was something that was very personal for James Hetfield that wasn't necessarily intended to even be a Metallica song. And it you know, is sort of a minor miracle that it made it onto an album, and then it becomes, you know, it's one of their two or three biggest songs of their career. Yeah.
Yes. No. Well, often, if you think about it, it's like, oh, this can be a metal song.
Yeah.
If you're not into metal.
yeah, exactly. It's so funny. They did away with this now, but I was just talking about this with somebody yesterday. I used to be part of the Grammy Award metal screening committee, where it was like, they would rotate us out every couple of years, but it's about a dozen people who work in the music business who know about metal or whatever. And we would take the hundreds of songs that were submitted for the Metal Grammy that year and go through them to determine if they were metal. And then once it passed through us, it went to the next category, to the next committee of people who chose the nominees. But, you know, a lot of them, we had a list and you could look at the list and go, Cannibal Corpse. Okay, yeah, it's in the right category. This doesn't need the pop or rock or whatever. But oftentimes those meetings would take all day and they would send an intern with a little stereo setup because we would have to listen to things sometimes like, maybe no one's familiar with the band or whatever, but where the arguments really happened, and there were lots of arguments, you know, I argued with someone who you know, and she's awesome. She's an executive at Live Nation. She definitely knows her shit. But I found myself one time arguing with this friend over an Iron Maiden song because she was saying it wasn't metal. because it was like some kind of ballad or something. It had been submitted for metal. Yeah. And I'm just going like, but it's Iron Maiden. You know, it doesn't. Yeah. It could be like reggae or country, but it's if it's Steve Harris and Bruce Dickinson, it's, you know, this goes in the metal category. And those are the arguments that would happen, you know.
Iron Maiden definitely goes to the metal category.
Yeah, it's very subjective. And that's how you end up with, you know, one year at the Grammys, you have Slipknot nominated in the hard rock category and nominated in the metal category. And it's like, well, you know,
it is so hard. It is so hard, especially in the States. I always had the feeling that under the world rock, there is a lot of things. Mm-hmm. In Europe, it's different because there are so many subcategories that if you are black metal, you're not a heavy metal. You're not epic metal. You're not another category. Yeah. Like in the States, it's always rock. Well, I like this. I hate to give names to music because it's like, why?
Yeah, and no one's ever, I mean, with few exceptions, of course, you have like, you know, true black metal and stuff like that. But but as a journalist, I can say, having interviewed so many musicians for the last 20 years or whatever, no one likes the category they're in anyway. You know, like you always, every band is like anxious to break out of the, however they're perceived, you know. If you talk to the guys from AFI and you say goth punk, it's like it's like anathema to, it's the worst thing that, you know, don't call
it.
I get it.
And, I mean, yeah. We've always been considered gothic metal, and it's just like, we are not gothic metal. I mean, when I think about gothic, I think about bands like Lacrimosa. Mm-hmm. We are not gothic. I don't know. I don't even know how to describe ourselves, but gothic metal, I got to the point that I'm like, yeah, whatever. Okay, it's okay. Gothic metal, okay.
And you know, that happens
like darkness,
too.
Darkness, so I like bats. Whatever, okay.
That happens too. The surrender to the subgenre. Yeah.
Yes.
I remember once upon a time I was doing a cover story on Dashboard Confessional. And this was like at the height of Dashboard's popularity. And I was told by his camp before the interview, don't say the word emo. It was like, yeah, but you're like the king of emo, you know. But I understand that in his mind, he's like, I don't want to be that thing that everyone calls me. And now, you know, fast forward in 2019, 2020, he was playing like emo night shows. the show was called Emo Night, and he played, you know. So there is kind of an eventual sort of like, okay, fine. This is
it's a sort of a love-hate thing. Yeah. Because, I mean, I get it that you kind of have to give a name somehow to give a description.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and if you're speaking conversationally, you know, if I'm recommending a band to you and I might say, it's like Typo Negative.
Yeah, that band kind of like, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
Normal, yeah.
Yeah, but when it's your band, and I understand this impulse, when it's your band and someone's like, oh, how would you describe the band? You want to say, we don't really sound like anything else out there. I don't know what to compare us to.
No, it's just that I really don't know, because, I mean, we are not the classic gothic metal bands. Mm-mm. And I would have no problems to say, yeah, we're a goth band. I mean, I love goth music. I have no problem with that. But I don't really think that if you tell to a person who specifically loves gothic metal, if you suggest Lacuna Coil, they might be disappointed somehow, because it's not, you know, kind of like that kind of music. It's also alternative. It's also rock. It's also electronic music. I don't know how to describe it, because there is so much thing in it.
Yeah. And that's the greatest bands. And that brings us kind of full circle. Like, you know, we were talking about Nothing Else Matters. It's not a traditional metal song by any measure, but it is a Metallica song, and it fits in with every Metallica record, despite standing apart, if that makes sense. You know, it's total
sense. It's the vibe.
Yes, the vibe.
It has the metal vibe. It doesn't really matter, even if it's a ballad.
And the charisma, as you said, it has the charisma and the identity of that band and those artists and what the combination of them creates.
Totally.
Well, I don't want to be too nosy about what you're working on right now, but what can you say?
I can say anything, just because we're gathering ideas. Marco, our bass player, is now in the mountains because he wanted to seclude it to seclude himself for a while without distraction to write more demos of music, some ideas. Andre and I, as soon as we are responsible as singers of lyrics, we're just like brainstorming, you know, we have an idea in mind, we want to talk about a specific thing, but I can't say anything because we're way too far from from everything, yeah. from even a demo, you know, to start to discuss. But there will be a new record, we are working on it, and I am excited, even if I feel, as many bands, that the previous record was not worked properly, and I'm pretty sad about it because Black Anima was very, very well received, mm-hmm. which is fantastic surprisingly album. Which is surprisingly after, you know, more than 20 years of a career. That doesn't happen very often, and I love every bit of this record, so I really wished, you know, that you know, this pandemic wouldn't happen for many reasons, but
sure.
The fact that I just wanted, you know, to continue touring and promote the record is one of them. So yeah, we will create something new.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you also, while I've got you, before we wrap up, I love that story about, because, you know, one of the interesting and unique things about Lacuna Coil's history was how quickly you were, you know, there were record labels interested, and how quickly you were with Century Media, and you know, as opposed to some bands that, you know, maybe toil away for 5 or 10 years before they can get any kind of interest. But I love that story about you working in the clothing shop and having could you tell me a little bit about that? I know it's was it Robert or Oliver or which Century Media person was it?
He was okay, long story short.
Yeah.
Ugh, horrible hair. Sorry. I just jumped out of the shower. I didn't even dry my hair.
You look fantastic. If this is you, if this is you horrible, then
oh yeah, yeah. This is yes. Yeah. Yes. Okay. We met in 93. So we started, you know, to make music more seriously, let's say, as a band in 95 96, and in 96 we did the demo tape with two songs that we recorded in a professional studio, because back then it was not possible to do it at your home, you know, with a computer.
Yeah,
because things were very, very different. So we made this cassette with two songs and we sent it to the labels we were interested in, basing ourselves on our taste. Let's say, okay, Typo Negative, let's see who produces this record. Let's see who's the company, who's the label. So yeah. There were addresses back behind the CD or cassettes. So we sent different little packages by mail, you know, regular mail, with a cassette, a picture taken from the neighbor of our bass player, who was a professional photographer, so kind of... So took a picture that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
A very, very short bio, because of course we didn't do anything back then. We just like played very, very, very few things. So we sent it around, and I was working in the store. It was my brother's store, a clothing store. And we had a fax machine. So all the conversation, okay. All the conversation was made through a fax machine, because of course back then, phone was very, very expensive. You know, even calling Germany was like something insane, and you would have a bill that was super, super high, which is crazy because it seems like I'm talking about prehistoric times, but
yeah, I remember
crazy 20 years ago. So one day I get a message on the fax machine that says, like, we're very interested in your material, we would like to hear more. And we got the same message from Century Media and Nuclear Blast.
Mm.
Eh.
The Germans, so before, the Germans are after you.
Yeah, the Germans were after us. I remember that some other labels weren't interested in us. I think we got rejected by Urich. We got a letter saying something like, you're not representing the style that we're looking for right now. Bad for you, Eric.
Whoops. Every label has those stories though too, right?
Yeah.
Oh, we passed on this band. We passed on this band. Yeah.
No, of course I'm kidding. I understand. And then basically we had to decide in between Century Media and Nuclear Blast. And what made us decide for Century Media, it's because Oliver came to Milano. Wow. So came to Milano with in the store. So I gathered all the guys in the store, and during the breaks, you know, in between opening, morning, afternoon, we met in the store, and it was a really raw meeting because there was no chairs. There was just one chair. Yeah. We were all sitting on the floor, you know, including the big boss of Century Media.
Yeah.
And funny, even funnier story, there was also Valerie that was working with Century Media back then, and he is now our manager.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's a full-on cycle.
Wow.
And basically he convinced us to sign for them, and we appreciated the fact that someone would even move from Germany, would fly on purpose to meet us all and to listen to what our plans were, what we wanted to do with our music. We really appreciated it. And I mean, we've been with Century Media since then.
Yeah.
Now, of course, as every relationship, we went through ups and downs, but we always discussed it and we always went through it. And I mean, this relationship lasted for quite a long time.
And I love, you know, Oliver, rest in peace. I love that that it was Oliver who went to Italy and sat on the floor in the clothing store, because of course, as you get to know Century Media, you discover that Robert is like the outgoing, arty, social, you know, creative guy, and Oliver was much
the party
more the
guy.
Business
Oliver
kind of,
is
you know,
the,
hard and, you know, ruffles feathers sometimes and whatever. And so it makes that story even so much more special to
that
imagine that it's him sitting down on the floor with you guys going, like, I love your band.
We really appreciated that, because it made us feel, I mean, can you imagine like a band from Milan, Italy? I mean, Italy is not known for having...
No, it's known for Lacuna Coil.
It doesn't have a rock and roll background. So for us, it was already a miracle that someone got interested in our music. And then we've been told that we were the very first band that was signed that they didn't know, that it wasn't in their circle of friends. So we have also been very lucky, because someone noticed us. Someone actually took the cassette, listened to it, and found some potential as something that was really naive, maybe in a way, because of course we were unexperienced. We didn't really know how to write songs, I guess. So basically we put everything we liked all together, and we created two songs from these songs you can probably write like 20 songs, just because we put so many riffs changes. So my name was like, it was a strange cassette.
That's like every rock drummer, when you talk to them 10 years in, 15, 20 years in, they always talk about how they're certain they just want to serve the song. But when they start out, they have to hit every possible drum and every possible cymbal and every part of every song.
Oh, I remember that we had conversations for years with one of our ex drummers, because he really wanted a huge chimes behind him. And like, we were like, no, we're not going to bring it to world a fucking huge chimes just to hit it once. No.
Yeah, they all come full circle to just be like Charlie Watts or Bill Ward after going through their like... you know, crazy phases. And I will say, you know, at the time, of course, there was no other story from Italy for a rock band or a metal band to really compare it to. Whereas now you've been this fantastic trailblazer, where if you're a band in Italy now, you can say, well, there's Lacuna Coil.
At least
we're from the country where Lacuna Coil is. Yeah, they did it. Maybe we can do it too. So last thing, and take your time, because I know it's putting you on the spot a little bit. Top five Metallica songs.
Well, nothing else matters. First one for sure. Enter Sandman. One. Uh, Master of Puppets.
You're already much faster than most people.
Because they are the classics. Yeah. You know, I just don't want to, you know, be the one that is going to search for the most intricate.
Most obscure B-side.
No, because I like them. No, I probably don't even know the B-sides. I'm not that expert. And there is another one that I like a lot, but I don't remember the title. Fuck.
Do you remember which record it's on?
No. Probably the Black Album. Am I missing one?
Yes, just one. We got Nothing Else Matters, Inner Sandman, One, and Master of Puppets.
There is another one that I love that it's still like a mellow song, kind of.
Unforgiven?
Yes.
We did it.
Thank you.
We did it.
Thank you. And that was another one of the songs that together with Nothing Else Matters that I was just like, oh, okay, I like this one. The very first time that I listened to them.
A gateway for sure. And still very dark and still very, one of my favorite, that might be my favorite Kirk Hammett solo is in that song. One of the best solos.
The never ending ending.
The never ending ending, and then there's the Unforgiven ending. 2 and the Unforgiven 3. The sequels, the franchise, the Unforgiven franchise. Yeah.
Why not?
It also is kind of full circle when we're, you know, talking about that idea of, you know, a song that could have been 20 songs. Inner Sandman is, you know, coming out of And Justice for All, where they did these like huge 10-minute epics and every riff in the world. And then to open the Black Album with Inner Sandman, which is basically one riff through the whole song.
Yeah.
It's Kirk's riff. Yeah. It's not even a James riff.
10 minute songs. Can you believe that? There's nothing like that anymore.
No, it's gotta be a workout.
I've been on stage with them once in Milano. Well, not Milano. It was in Raw, which is like a few minutes from Milano. They played a show. It was a festival, and Fate No More were opening. And I remember that I was so pissed because people booed them. And I love Fate No More, so I was just like, "Don't do that!" I love Metallica, but don't boo Fate No More. But beside that, there was a friend of mine who was working in the organization, so he was just like, "Where do you want to see the show from?" And I was just like, "Whatever, you know, just like give me, you know, a nice spot to watch the concert." And I was like right behind Lars, because it was that tour where they put all the people behind them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was like right behind him. And I was just like feeling almost embarrassed because I was there, you know, with all the fans. And I usually love to watch concerts from far away because I want to see the lights and everything. But the experience was so magical because it was literally like being on stage with them because they were interacting with each other. So everybody would come, you know, to us. But I was just like feeling like, I don't know, embarrassed. And I was like, what if I have to pee? I have to stay here 3 hours. But it was great. It was a great experience, but I felt so exposed.
Yeah, and it's one of those situations where you, in the back of your mind, you're waiting for someone to come up and go like, "You don't belong here. You can't stand here."
And you know, I felt so.
Even though you know you can, and you do.
Oh my god! Yeah, the day after, all my friends was, "Oh my god, we saw your picture," and I was like,
"Oh, that's so great." Yeah, and like to the Faith No More thing, like Metallica, but especially I think Maiden and Slayer. Sort of notoriously difficult bands to open for anybody, no matter who you are.
with Slayer, I remember because we played, that was years and years and years and years ago. We were playing at the same festival and they would call Slayer regardless with every band. And I wouldn't understand because I was just like, yeah, they're coming up. I mean, they're coming. If you call them now, they're not going to come up anyway. So I didn't really understand that. I know you guys love it, but they're going to come up.
Yeah, there's no precedent. It's never once happened that you've yelled for the other band and they've come and pushed the opening band off stage and started early.
Exactly. Slayer are not going to play at 9 in the morning because you're like saying Slayer.
All the Slayer and Maiden fans have always, hoping that this is going to be the show. It's finally going to happen. They're going to come out early. That's great. I never even thought about that. Like, yeah, it's like, what's the purpose? Like, yeah, they're.
Yeah,
I mean, you're here, man. You're at the show.
It must be hard because, I mean, they're a legendary band. But,
of course.
But at the same time, I mean, you're still going to see the band you love. So I never really understood, you know, this aggressiveness towards the opening band.
Yeah.
Because it's not that if you boo a band, your favorite band is going to play longer anyway, because they're going to have their time. And they might also be friends of your favorite band.
Nine times out of ten, you're disrespecting
the band you went to see.
Yeah.
Eh, whatever. Part of the package, I guess.
That reminds me, there was a great story when Metallica did Lollapalooza in the 90s. It was the same lineup everywhere. Back when it was a touring festival, but there were like a dozen bands that rotated as special guests each show, so you didn't know which one you were going to get. The Wu-Tang Clan was one of them. But when the show came to Indianapolis, where I grew up, the special guest was Waylon Jennings, country artist.
Oh,
and James Hetfield had picked him personally. So Waylon Jennings was playing, as the story goes, and the crowd was booing and not into it. And it's the middle of the afternoon, and James Hetfield comes walking out on stage and says, This man's here because I wanted him to be here. Show him some respect.
Oh my God. I love this. I love this. Good job, James. Good job.
It's one of my favorite stories. Respect.
Like, if you don't like a band, you don't need to cheer for this band. You can have a beer. You can eat something. But just like to show this respect, it's too much. I never did it with any band. If I don't like an artist, if I don't show disrespect, because that's very mature. It's no.
Yeah. Good imagine going to like an art gallery and like booing a painting. Oh,
this sucks. Yeah. This artist fucking sucks.
You're at the library and you're just throwing books that you don't like.
Yeah.
It is crazy. Well, Christina, thank you so much for doing
this
today.
You're welcome. It was a great conversation.
Yes. Thank you. I was very much looking forward to it. And yeah, like I said, it felt like it was a long time coming because you've been on the list of people I've always wanted to speak to and never have gotten to. So have a good rest of your evening there. And
thank you.
Thanks again.
Thank you very much.